So let me quickly introduce Sarana, our today's speaker. And so we agreed in a preparatory meeting that I will only briefly introduce her, and she will add a couple of things from her perspective on her trajectory through the different sciences. She started in psychology with a bachelor's degree in psychology, in addition philosophy and sociology, from Osmania University in India, where she also gets her master's degree from. And then she moved to Europe, to the University of Sussex in the UK, and wrote her doctoral dissertation on investigating the effect of a computer tool on students' metacognitive processes. That was in a school, or in the School of Cognitive and Computing Sciences. And from there, I mean, she will tell us a little bit more about a couple of stations from assistant to associate, and now a full professor at the Department of Education Psychology in the School of Education of the University of Wisconsin in Madison. One of her stations I found very interesting, and maybe she will also refer to this one, is was Georgia Tech, where she has been working on learning by design, I think together with Janet Kolodner. So, Sarana, the floor is yours. If you could give, well, your perspective on your own trajectory or your own career, and then, of course, we are looking forward to your talk. Let me quickly mention two things. We are recording this webinar, and if you don't want, I don't mean you, Sarana, I mean everyone else. If you don't want to be on the recording that will be openly on the web afterwards, then you should just not use the video chat, and maybe just contribute by the type chat. And what turned out to be a very good way to give the speaker some feedback that you are still following is using the little smileys, which are on the lower, in the lower right corner, quite close to the chat, and you can just use these smileys from time to time, or if Sarana is asking something, you can use that. Okay, and then in the end, Daniel will remind us again with respect to a little evaluation that we do or have to do after the webinar, so to in order to improve this series. Okay, Sarana, the floor is yours. We are looking forward to your talk.
Hello, everyone. First of all, thanks. A big thank you to Frank for organizing these webinar sessions, and to your whole team for this incredible series, which, you know, my students have always been going back to and downloading the videos and watching the videos. And thank you for inviting me to be part of this. I realize that it's not only Friday evening in Europe, but it's also Good Friday. So thank you all for coming. And I hope that, you know, we can have a good time for the next hour or so. As far as my trajectory is concerned, I did come from a very experimental psychology background. As Frank just mentioned, both my bachelor's and master's were in psychology, where I conducted, you know, lab-based, very regimental studies. And then my PhD also was, you know, in the School of Cognitive and Computing Sciences, which was also, again, you know, I conducted very controlled studies during my dissertation. But I think my life trajectory or my career trajectory changed when I became a postdoc at Georgia Tech, and for the first time started going into real classrooms and looking at how kids learn in real classrooms, how technology, you know, the best designs, what happens to them when you put them in a real classroom. And that completely changed my perspectives and perspective. And since then, I've been doing a lot of classroom-based research. But a lot of times, of course, the psychologist in me does come up and ask some of the same questions that critics of design-based research have asked, like, what about rigor? What about replication? What about generalization? So I hope that we can discuss some of these today. If you go to the first slide, which is my overview slide, what I'm going to talk about today is, you know, in general, what is design-based research, And what are the key assumptions of design-based research? Like, what are the characteristics? And then I'm going to go into one particular aspect of design-based research in somewhat more detail, which is like, what are the trajectories of design-based research? Is it a single study? Is it a set of studies? And how do you plan those studies? So going a little bit into, you know, how you do DBR or design-based research, and then some of the challenges and criticisms. I'm hoping to have like little sections of going over my slides, and then perhaps we can have some small group discussions so that, you know, I'm not the only one speaking all the time, and I get some ideas and questions from you as well. So to start with, you know, what is design-based research? One of the things I think happens because it's a new methodology is that everyone has a different understanding of design-based research. And I just wanted to take a couple of minutes, not too long, where maybe, you know, you could tell me what your understanding of design-based research is. What do you think design-based research is? And we could take like 2 or 3 minutes where you can think about it, and maybe we can get a few of you at least to chime in. So let me stop here, and you could take 2 or 3 minutes and tell the others what you think design-based research is.
I don't know, can anyone hear us? I'm here to learn. I'm not a very well acquainted with design-based research, but I do enjoy design theory and wanted to get more information on this particular method.
Well, for me, as far as I know, design-based, or the special thing about design-based research is that it is about an intervention that is implemented in a natural setting and is then iteratively changed and modeled to better fit the setting and to reach the goal or the aim of the intervention.
Well, okay. I think that does summarize some of the key elements of design-based research. So going back to Anne Brown's seminal article on design experiments, that was in 1992, and actually the start of this idea of trying out a new innovation, a new design in the context of a classroom, in a real environment. And since then, in the learning sciences, there have been several special issues, several books, several articles written on what design-based research is. And basically, you know, it is, as Chris just mentioned, it is a theory-driven, and I'm on slide 2 now, design of learning environments combined with empirically driven research. So the two aspects of, you know, the theory-driven design of learning environment, as well as the empirical nature of, you know, how this innovation is tried out in a real context, forms the crux of design-based research. And how do these innovations work in real-world context? So not only are we designing, but we're also trying to figure out ways in which, you know, when you put an innovation into context, ways in which it works, and the different elements of the context that come into play as you put something into practice. So I have a question, you know, whether design-based research only applies to K-12 or higher education. And I think as we go through this talk, that will be clearer. The examples that I have are from K-12, but there is no reason why this methodology cannot be applied to other settings, as long as, you know, the key assumptions are met. So going on to my slide number 4, which is which starts with the key assumptions of design-based research. So one of the most important assumptions, one of the most important characteristics of design-based research is design. So design is at the core of DBR, and design of a learning environment. And that learning environment provides what we call engineered learning opportunities for students. So because of the characteristics of, let's say, maybe the software or the tools or the materials. They could be curricula, they could be, ways in which collaborative discourse is structured or ways in which the teaching practices are structured. All of these form learning opportunities that are engineered by the designers. And that design is really at the center of learning environments and at the center of design-based research. But it's the key thing about the design is that the hypotheses that the designers work from, or the core assumptions, the core theoretical assumptions of the designers, are actually embodied in the design. So perhaps you have a software about, you know, how your theoretical notions about argumentation, or about your notions about collaborative discourse, and that notion is embodied in your software, in your tools, in your materials. So it's design, but it is theoretically driven design. And then when you try out this design in a particular context, the design becomes a testbed for innovation and further refining and understanding how students learn. And as somebody just mentioned in the chat also, another key assumption is this whole notion of iteration. So as you have designed a learning environment consisting of several components, what you're now doing is going through iterative cycles of design, enactment, analysis, and redesign in a particular context. And the designed innovation then is iteratively refined, and after each iteration, the design may be revised, or the theories underlying may be refined a little bit, or at the minimal, at least you understand how those theories work in a particular context. And one of the things that has been talked about in design-based research a little less, and that is what I'm going to focus on today, is this whole notion of trajectory. So as I said before, you know, what does it mean to do design-based research? So when you're doing design-based research, is it just one study? Is it multiple studies? Is it multiple studies along a trajectory? And how would you design that trajectory then? What are some things that you need to take into consideration? So even though iteration is at the core of design-based research, what does it mean to iteratively refine your design? And also, what does it mean to refine the theory underlying it? I have a question. I like this because, you know, people are asking questions as we go along, so it's more interactive. Is DBR theory-driven or theory-generating, or both? And I would say both, but I think this is a question that we can probably come back to at the end, or, you know, after I've gone through some of the examples and discuss a little bit more. So going back to my sixth slide now, one of the key assumptions, so I talked about design, I talked about iteration, and the third key assumption is context. So not only do you have a design innovation which you're iteratively refining, but you're trying it out in a real world context. So it might be a classroom setting, it might be an after school club, it might be a museum setting, it could be any formal or informal environment, but you're trying to test it in a real context, which is like way different from doing it in a lab. And once you take something into an authentic context, then you have to think about several interacting variables, several elements in the context. There are multiple elements. There are students, you know, for example, in a classroom, there are students, there are teachers, there are constraints of the curriculum, and the resources available, and all of these interact in multiple ways. And what you need to account for is, you know, how that affects learning. So it becomes, as Anne Brown in her you know, very famous article now called The Booming, Buzzing Confusion of a Classroom. And when you take all of those factors into consideration, how does your design work and what are some things that you learn as you implement that design in a classroom? So often in design-based research, you see that, you know, you have to use qualitative as well as a lot of inductive approaches because you're not aware of how things will interact with each other a priori. So a lot of your qualitative research, like any qualitative research, is also inductive. And as you understand how this design works in a classroom, how your innovation works in a real setting, then you're also asking a lot of the how and why question and not just the what question. So what did students learn is a great question, but how did they learn and why did they learn, where you take into account the different elements of the context into consideration. Slide 7 now. I wanted to throw this question because even though a lot has been written about design-based research, there are also a lot of critics for this approach, you know, who think that design-based research, you know, it kind of dilutes the methodology and it's like anything goes. So I put across these three key assumptions: design, iteration, and context. And I wanted to ask you to think about, like, what is so unique about this? Are there other disciplines that do this? So why should design-based research be so considered unique? Again, we'll take a couple of minutes. I don't know, Frank, whether we should set up like small groups among the students who are just by themselves or whether we can use the chat function. Either is fine with me.
So it's easy. I have created two breakout groups already. And it's quite easy. We can try. I will post them now. So there are two links, and it stops. Sorry, that was mixed up a little bit. I will try again. So there is a breakout group number one. This is here, and then there's breakout group number two, which is this one. So we can have you should give us a time, Sadhana, so say 5 or 7 minutes, and then people can go there, discuss among each other, and then return. It's important to close the other tab then and not to have two meetings open at the same time when you come back. And we should be just silent here in this group, in this room.
Yeah, I would say 5 minutes, no more than 5 minutes, because there's a lot to cover also. Okay, I'm guessing everybody is back and we can start again.
So, Sadhana, I think most of us are back now.
Sounds good. So maybe somebody from group one and maybe somebody from group two can give like a short report from the group.
So someone suggested me for some reason, so Nicholas. I just stopped for group two. I didn't hear the voice for group one. There was no sound, but it was not my problem. I think Daniel also had a problem. So maybe someone else from group two, from group one, could also go on with that. What we talked about was yes, in the end, we had some kind of discussion about that it is. That we have no finite steps in that design-based research, so it will grow and change and so on. We also said that that it can be applied to different contexts. So maybe someone else has to add something.
Okay. We talked about a variety of different things. We were in group one or two. We were just sort of chatting amongst ourselves. And we talked a lot about the idea in terms of uniqueness. There are, in sociology, we've got ethnography and anthropology ethnography. And it was discussed in the article as well. And that's even a looser kind of idea than design-based research in terms of uniqueness. We were also discussing this idea that teachers kind of do more informal design-based research in their classrooms when they do action research as well. They might set a goal for ways that they want to improve student learning and then try different things out. And perhaps it may not be as theoretically grounded as Sadhana was discussing, but it's still this idea that they're iterating all the time in their classrooms. And so that was another thing we talked about. Catherine also shared her experiences in doing research in a museum context. I don't know if you wanted to talk about that.
Yeah. So with museum education and particularly visitor engagement activities for the public, it's highly iterative. So you make a lot of different changes at once. So it's not quite as structured as something as design-based research, but it still has the same approach, maybe less of a theoretical framework. But there's a constant evaluation to see what really seems to be reaching the public, how it's enriching their museum experience, and how they're walking away from the museum with more knowledge than they had before.
Okay, I don't know whether there are any more thoughts, but in the interest of time, maybe I can discuss this a little bit. I think critics of design-based research, you know, so what's so unique about it? You know, if any of you have done software design, you iteratively design your software and you tweak design features and have informant design studies or participatory design, and you are constantly modifying your design. Just as Dana just mentioned, you know, teachers or those who do action research, for example, are reflecting on their practice and changing their practice iteratively. There are methods of ethnography, you know, that we use to understand the context better. But what is unique in design-based research is that you're simultaneously refining your design as well as building theories at the same time. So it's not as, you know, for lack of a better word, loose as some people might think it is, but there is, you know, a more concerted effort and a better documentation of, you know, how, or at least should be, of how the design is functioning in a context. What are the variables in the context that you're testing? And as I go over my examples, perhaps this will become a little bit more clearer that what is unique is that there is a simultaneous concern about, you know, refining the design or the innovation, as well as developing theories of learning. And these two goals are tightly intertwined. So sometimes it can lead to, you know, things being loose or, you know, looking at too many things at the same time. If any of you have read Chris Deedy's article about, you know, titled, If Design-Based Research is the Answer, What's the Question? So, you know, a lot of design-based researchers collect too much data because, you know, it's it could be more exploratory. So how do we answer those critics? And, you know, how do we make sure that there is a clear trajectory and that there is the goals for each cycle are clearer where you're refining the design as well as developing theories of learning? I'm on slide 8 now. So, you know, which talks about this issue of both pragmatic goals as well as theoretical goals, which are closely intertwined. And one of the things that several articles mention is that the theories that we develop are humble theories because, you know, they might be domain specific and they are also related to the design innovation. How does all this happen? How do we do DBR is the next portion of my talk. Does anyone have any questions? If you can put them in the chat. Just a minute, in the next minute or so, before I move on to how we do design-based research. Well, I take that as a no. So I'm on the next portion of my chat, my talk, which is how do you do design-based research? Yes, it's all fine to say, you know, you're at the same time concerned about the design and about the innovation as well as the theories, but what does that mean and how do you design a program? So, as I said before, I'm specifically going to focus on trajectories of design-based research and bring in these ideas of designing and innovation and at the same time adding to the theory as I talk about a couple of examples, one from my own work. And this whole idea that, you know, choices need to be made during each iteration, during each study. What type of data do you collect? What type of questions do you ask? And each iteration becomes what I call an informing cycle that adds to or helps us plan the next study in the trajectory. And one of the articles that you read for in preparation for this webinar was the one by Collins and his colleagues, and there he has discussed the Fostering Learning Communities of Learners project. You know, this is Anne Brown and Joe Campion's project, which started off, you know, there you can see a very clear trajectory of how it started and how it expanded to many different classrooms in the end. So it started with the approach of reciprocal teaching, which is completely grounded in, you know, theories of reading comprehension and theories of metacognition. So there were underlying theoretical assumptions that guided those studies. And the study started with single students to start with, and then in resource rooms or small groups in schools, and then were expanded to a classroom situation. And later, they had several classrooms where they tried to inculcate this approach of fostering a community of learners where reciprocal teaching was part of it, but kids were involved in other activities such as researching a topic and discussing amongst each other and coming up with a solution for a problem. And Collins describes the phases of FCL, which I won't go into detail because not only I won't go into detail, but you see there that not only was the grain size of the studies different, the data that was collected different, but they also added many different conceptual things to their practice. So for example, the communities of learners became communities of practice when they involved experts and others from the community. They thought about diverse expertise in a classroom where students during collaboration could use the jigsaw method and used and students with different expertise could take on like one part or one role during the jigsaw. They designed new materials, so that was the design part of it, and they also expanded this approach not only laterally but also vertically to different grades. So they were refining the design at the same time, but they were also adding to, you know, what they were learning about how students learn by expanding the reciprocal teaching to how you can have these communities of learners in a classroom. So that is one trajectory. And then the other trajectory, that is one trajectory that actually looks at, you know, how theory is refined as well as the design is refined as you go through design-based research. But I will go into a little bit more detail from my own work. And I'm on slide 11 now. So my project is called the Compass Project, and basically what we do in my project is that we have a learning environment, a designed learning environment that uses digital text and design activities as well as simulations, and those are designed to help students learn science in a middle school classroom. And the motivating principle that we started with was to enable an in-depth analysis, in-depth cohesive understanding of content rather than multiple disconnected topics, and integrate science tech in the context of a classroom. So the key learning principle was for a cohesive understanding of science content, and students needed to learn science as a connected body of knowledge and see and understand connections. So that was the key learning principle that we were trying to promote, because a lot of science learning in middle schools especially is very fact-based, especially when students are learning through a textbook. So how were these, we started with that key principle, and how was this then embodied into our material? So we started off with designing the digital textbook, which is called Compass, and I'm on slide 12 now, which enabled students to see connections between science ideas. So the design of the software actually embodied our key assumption of helping students learn science as a connected body of knowledge. And as you see in the screenshot there, we have two representations. One is a conceptual representation of the ideas that students are learning, and the second is a text representation or a text description. And every time students select a concept, that concept becomes the focus, and the most related concepts are at the first level in the concept map, and the ones that are not as closely related are in the periphery. And the maps are dynamic and they zoom in and out so that every time you click on a concept, that concept becomes the focus. And what we were trying also to see here is the maps actually provide different levels of coherence. So as anyone who has dealt with digital text, you know, the text can be in different segments unless you have a PDF that is, you know, that you scroll and it's just linear text presented digitally. You have to have some kind of coherence in a digital text that is in different segments for students to be able to see how the different segments are connected. So we were thinking about not only local coherence, which the reading comprehension literature has a lot of, as well as you know, some kind of global coherence or intertextual coherence. And the maps actually provided the intertextual coherence, but they also made students understand the connections or see the connections between different concepts and principles. So with this, we started our first iteration, which was very much like any kind of software design studies. So we started with usability studies in the lab, and then there were some, they were followed by small group studies for usefulness. Are kids actually learning something? And of course, like in any software design, the outcome of this iteration was that there was a refinement of the representations, because it was very hard to figure out what to show in the concept map, and how should we constrain the map so that, you know, not everything is related to everything else. So there was a revision of the maps or the representations, and a revision of the text for readability also. But then in our second iteration, we wanted to see whether, you know, providing a conceptual representation of this kind actually does result in students understanding connections, or do they see the network of ideas that represent science. So our questions then were, you know, understanding the role of structure and coherence provided by the concept maps, and how do students learn from multiple digital texts, and how does system structure or the coherence and intratextual and intertextual coherence provided in the system affect navigation and learning. And in this particular iteration, even though we conducted the studies in a classroom, we were able to set up cases where, you know, a set of classrooms used the concept map version of Compass, and another set used a table of contents only version. And we were able to see that students are able to learn the connections better, learn about the network of ideas better in the concept map condition. However, not all students learned through looking at the representation alone. Our observations that we collected in classrooms, we found that some of the students, especially who came with low prior knowledge or had difficulties learning, were not able to use the conceptual representation of that the maps provided. So we looked at, you know, literature on metacognition and studying from text. And one of the things that we wanted to include in our next iteration was this notion of meta-navigation support is, you know, helping students to reflect on the different connections that the maps are showing and how those relate to their goals. So we provided them with scaffolding for navigation and learning to help them see the connections and relate them to their goals and reflect on, you know, what nodes they should select next. And in this study, again, we were able to set up conditions with meta navigation support or no support. And we found that the support actually helps students make more coherent transitions related to their goals rather than jumping around and just selecting, you know, nodes just for the sake of it. And we also found that in this study, things like reading comprehension ability and the presence of the support as well as prior domain knowledge significantly predicted students' understanding of science principles. But not only, I mean, we were able to set up these conditions and have, an empirically conducted study and data analysis during this iteration, but we also started to collect initial data on classroom implementations, like what are the strategies that teachers are using, what are the kinds of discourse that are going on in the classroom. And this was mainly preliminary through videos in the classroom. And it helped us get an understanding of how the curriculum, how the system and the curriculum gets implemented in the classroom. And that led actually to our third iteration, because what we found was that even though our guiding principle was to help students understand connections among science, the software alone wasn't able to do it. What we actually needed to do was also design curriculum around it, because the curricula that the teachers were following did not actually promote making connections to the extent that we would have liked. So we ended up designing a whole curriculum along the lines of our underlying assumptions, as well as thinking about how can we best support teachers through this curriculum. So because the curriculum was design based, you know, how do you help students to go between the concrete design activities and the abstract science that they were learning in the text? And how can teachers help students make those connections? So with that major revision after iteration two, we then went to iteration three, where we really focused on understanding the enactments in more detail. So what are the strategies that teachers use to help students understand connections between science ideas? And what are the strategies that teachers use to help students go between the abstract and the concrete instantiations of science concepts and principles. I won't go into too much detail. I'm not going into too much detail of any of those iterations because, I just want to get across the idea that of the trajectory that we followed. But as a result of iteration three, we were able to come up with a constellation of strategies that teachers followed for successful student learning. But along the way, we also conducted several lab studies. And this is one thing that Anne Brown also talks about in her article on design experiments, that there will be times where, you know, classroom, you find some things in classroom research that you might want to try out in a focused lab-based study to further refine that idea, to further refine that finding. So along the way, we also conducted smaller lab-based studies with students of varying abilities or with experts also to kind of help with our classroom studies. And as I have on my slide 18, a quote from Shay Wilson, as well-formulated questions arise, for example, about which alternative activities or changes in an applet, for example, are most likely to lead to a designed outcome, a small randomized might be used within a classroom. So even though, you know, many of our studies were in the classroom, we actually used smaller studies to kind of inform the classroom studies. And then our fourth iteration was in multiple contexts, because now that we knew that the curriculum was working and the software was working and the different things that students could do with the software, we wanted to try out in many different contexts to see whether, you know, we find the same things or whether teachers use different strategies, and how does variations in the resources in a school or teacher preparation or different student populations, how do they use this particular learning environment. Another thing that we wanted to also learn in more detail was, you know, what kind of knowledge building do students engage in as they interact in groups with each other. So that was, you know, our trajectory in my own research. So coming back to how it applies to design-based research, each iteration in my project, or even in the FCL example, the design, enact, and redesign led to hypotheses that were tested in the next cycle. And after each iteration, we did refine the design, and it also helped us confirming or refining our underlying assumption that, you know, to help students learn science, the connections in science. But at the same time, we were also understanding more issues in context. You know, what can teachers do to promote making connections? What can teachers do so that the science that students were learning was robust? And each time we had different types of data and different grain sizes of data, because we didn't collect, you know, everything in every study. So one of the things that I think is talked about a little bit less in design-based research is this whole idea of a trajectory of studies. So as students doing doctoral research, I don't see that, you know, any one study can be qualified as design-based research. It could be an iteration or a particular study in a trajectory of studies, and it could inform that trajectory in some way. We don't see a lot of articles in the learning sciences literature that talk about, you know, how these trajectories are formed, what kinds of decisions, the design decisions that you make, how does your you know, how do you refine your design, and how do you refine your theory at the same time, you know? And there are several large research projects that undertake design-based research, there is little written about, you know, this iterative development and how you go about the trajectory of studies. So I hope that, you know, by talking about my own example, this was a little bit clearer, but I'm happy to take questions. And I just want to reiterate that there could be multiple studies along a trajectory, and each study could look at, you know, a different part of your overall research agenda, and together these studies cumulatively add to the knowledge about how students learn in particular context and in using your innovative design that you have used. So I'll take some questions, and also we can then discuss, like, how do you plan such a trajectory?
Juan, you were about to say something. Maybe you could try again. But I would have a question. Not sure if this is now the right point in time, so I don't know. But for me, an important question with respect to design-based research has been the grain size, or the nature of these theories, or the theoretical outcomes. So let's say, advising some of my PhD students who plan to apply, or who are about to apply design-based research in, say, a series of courses in a continuing education environment at the university where the course is repeated over and over again. I think it's a good opportunity, but when they ask me what kind of theory do you expect me to develop, that is, for me, it's an extremely hard question. And also they ask me, could you give some examples for these types of theories? And this is where I always struggle. So where would you people point to with respect to these theories? Maybe that's at a later point of this webinar, but that is one of my burning questions.
Yeah, so I don't know whether I'm answering your question exactly, Frank, but I think when we think about how do you do design-based research, I personally would say that, you know, what are your underlying theoretical assumptions would be the first question to ask. And once, maybe you want to study how what kind of argumentation happens in small groups. Maybe you want to study how, in undergraduate education, what kind of things students are writing or how do they reflect on their learning. So as long as you start with, some question and which I guess we do all the time as researchers, what is the underlying theoretical assumption for your design innovation and how do you, how is that embedded in your design? I think that would be the starting point. I don't know whether that answers your question. So I think there's a question about, yes, recognizing the problem first and thinking about what your underlying assumptions are. And then there's a question about different grain sizes and different types of data. So, and that's, of course, a loaded question. So you might collect data and analyze it at a very, very fine-grained level, but you may not do that in each study. It depends on what your particular impetus is for that particular study. So for example, one of the things that Shavelson talks about in his critique of design-based research, or critique and explanation and asking some devil's advocate questions in the educational research article, is you could start a project with studies that are looking at what is happening. So maybe you are trying out something in a classroom, but you are at a very coarse-grained level trying to figure out what is happening. And you're not going into much detail any particular kind of data, but overall you're looking at, how are the students reacting, how are the students using your innovation, what are the teachers doing, so what he calls what is happening. And then, based on that, you might refine your hypotheses, you might come up with hypotheses, and then have like a more focused study looking at particular aspects of your innovation. And then the grain size would be very different. Or in some cases, you might think about, a randomized trial to test one of your hypotheses or a particular feature of your design. I hope that answers the question. Okay, so you're exploring what is happening, still have some assumptions that something could be better? Yes, absolutely. So, it is not completely a fishing expedition, but because your designed innovation is based on, what you think are the theoretical assumptions that it embodies, you're still looking for some specific things.
Hello, I have a question. In the beginning, we have discussed if the this research method can be theory generating. So if the theory is not a strong theory, say, but if you have an idea, for example, of a certain learning technique, not even necessarily method, and you can try it, you can see what is working, what is not, and then you try to improve it with several iterations, and by the end you produce a refined technique for a specific domain, for example. Can this be considered a theory generating approach?
good question, and my students are here. So one of the things that I always promote is that you start with a good theoretical understanding and are very clear about the theoretical assumptions underlying whatever your study or your design is. So I think, yes, in terms of, refining a technique or refining a particular piece of software or some technique, I think it is okay to iteratively refine it. But in the end, you have to ground it in something, and you have to ground it in knowledge about how people learn and what are your assumptions for designing that technique in the first place.
Not sure if, since I can see only myself, do you hear me, I assume? I keep listening to you, and I think that the problem, The problem is that design-based research has still two parts. It's the research on a design process. So that's the complexity. The research questions are still based on design of an instructional process. So the instructional process needs theories. You have to be very careful with what you choose. And then the research is following basically what you design, and based on the answers you get, you will change the design. So I don't think that the research questions drive the design. It's in a way the design or the innovation, or how do you want to call it, will drive the nature of the research question that you ask. And this will change because the design will change in time.
Well, I think you bring up a very key idea in doing design-based research, because it is very possible, and it has been written about. One of the criticism in the JLS special issues, special issue of design research, particularly, that you can be very pragmatic and keep refining your design, but I think if you're not at the same time building theories about or understanding how people learn, then it could be just optimizing an instructional design as opposed to taking into consideration these two intertwined goals of design-based research, that not only is your not only are you designing an innovation, but that innovation is grounded in theory, and you're helping, you're trying to understand how people learn using that design. So I would say, just having iteratively refine an instructional design would not qualify as design-based research. And it's probably one of the pitfalls of, using this terminology, that design is a key aspect. And yes, you can keep optimizing a design, but design-based research came about in the learning sciences, in educational research. So if you're not learning about how people learn at the same time, then I think it loses some of its value.
Well, it seems like it. You're right. I'm not saying you're not right, but the problem is, that's how I see the theory is part of the design. So when you design something, if you don't ground the design in the theory, you're just trying to play around with design strategies or facts. So that's why I try to say that, in a way, for me, a good design is grounded in the theory, and by doing research on how that theory works, you might end up with another variation of the theory, so-called proto-theory, so you can end up with a new theory by doing research on how that theories work into your design. So that's what I try to say, which is, totally in agreement with what you just said. And I'm glad that you pointed that, it went out the wrong way in what I said first time.
Yeah, so I think we agree. Do people have any other questions? So I see a question on qualitative versus quantitative methods of analyzing data. And I think this will become a little bit clearer probably when I go over the next few slides, but let me answer it anyway. I think we do collect both qualitative and quantitative kinds of data in design-based research. And they are different ontologies, but if you're trying to answer the question of how people learn and taking into account, what's the various multiple elements in the context, then you can't be collecting only a single form of data. But again, this depends on your research questions. And when I go over like some of the trajectories of design-based research in a little bit, maybe this will be a little bit clearer, but we can revisit the question after a bit. So let's see what slide am I on. Okay, so I'm on slide 23. How are we doing on time? Okay, I think we're doing okay. So how do you, how do you frame this trajectory of multiple studies? And of course, you'll find a lot of things written on this, but this is my take and people might vary. So I think I would start with like, what are the underlying theoretical assumptions? And then how are these embedded in your tools? Be it software, curricula, practices, participatory structures in a classroom, or the discourse in a classroom. And then your questions could be about, the design of the innovation itself, where, in the first stages, you might just refine the design in some way or particular features of the design by conducting any randomized trials, or they might be about the theory, or they might be about implementation, or they might be about all of them, depending on, where you are at in your trajectory. And based on your questions, what is the sequence of studies that you can plan? And a recent article by Bill Sandoval talks about conjecture mapping and how, in each study, you can start, you start with your assumptions and map your conjectures to, the kinds of tools you design, the kinds of discourse structures that you design, and so on. And I won't go into detail of that, but what I would like to really point out is that I think when we talk about design-based research, one thing that as researchers, and I'm probably guilty of it also, we don't do very well is to kind of plan this trajectory of studies ahead of time. And yes, we all say that design-based research is, based on informing cycles and based on evolution and the questions are emergent, but I think we need to have at least some idea of the kinds of things that we might be able to study in each study. So some idea of what that trajectory would look like. Yes, we will be refining our hypotheses. We will be refining the design, but without really planning out your studies ahead of time, it becomes like, very easily going into just optimizing the design and not really being conscious about, about research. So I did want to take some time, maybe 5 minutes again, and what do you think some of the criticisms of design-based research are? Is it like anything goes and there is no rigor? There's, how do you make sure that you have rigor and that you're doing good research when you talk about design-based research? So let's take 5 minutes or so and do breakout groups again, yes, Frank, and talk about your concerns and criticisms.
So I think most or all of us are here. Could you show a smiley if you are back in the plenary?
Okay, sounds good. I just want to take a couple of minutes before we start discussing the criticisms and talk about one big criticism that has been around for design-based research, and it is this issue of rigor. You know, how do you make sure that, you know, your studies are rigorous and empirically rigorous? So the two graphics that I have in the document called figures, I have tried, and this is again my attempt at kind of teasing out some of the complexity of design-based research. So you will see two graphics where I try to map, you know, the kinds of questions. And like I just said, you know, these are only two dimensions that you could map studies on, and there could be several others. But this is kind of like my first attempt in trying to think about, you know, what does a trajectory look like, and what does it mean to have different kinds of studies along a trajectory. So I have my mapped around two dimensions. It is, you know, how open-ended or specific your questions are, and how complex your environment is. So in figure one, you see one particular trajectory where you might start with very specific questions and smaller studies. So, you know, you can make sure that, you know, your studies are rigorous and you have specific hypotheses that you're trying to test in that particular small group or small study situation. And then you might expand it to a single classroom where, you know, you might have two different conditions or one condition where you're trying to understand what is happening in a classroom, and eventually expand to multiple classrooms. And it is also likely that you might go from, you know, smaller studies to multiple open questions in a classroom, kind of like what I said, you know, trying to look at, you know, what is happening in a complex environment. How does your design innovation fare in the complex environment of a classroom? And the second one, second figure that I have, again, you know, kind of traces, you know, doing studies with single students and then studies in smaller groups or resource group and single classroom, going into multiple classroom along the same dimension. So your questions might still be very specific, but you're expanding to a more complex environment. So you are increasing the complexity of the environment, but keeping your questions, you know, very specific. And then in red on the other side of the graphic, you see that your questions are open, but you start with, you know, smaller group studies and go to slowly increase the complexity of your environment. So in each of these cases, you could plan your studies based on, you know, what your hypotheses are at, for any one of these elements in your study. And think about, you know, how, you know, what kinds of data you collect, and the really address the issue of rigor. You know, if it's just a specific research question, you're taking into account the complexity of the environment, then you can really tease apart, you know, what is going on in that environment. If it's an open question as well as a complex environment, then it's a very complex study, and you have to tease apart multiple aspects. So, you know, it's just my attempt at looking at two dimensions, but there could be more. And I think as researchers in the learning sciences, we need to think about, you know, where do our studies go in this overall landscape of and how can we make sure that we specify the kinds of things we're doing, the kinds of data that we're collecting, and also address the issue of rigor. Because I don't think that just because you're doing design-based research means that there can't be any rigor. I think within each study, you can be as rigorous as any other discipline. So can we take any challenges, questions that the groups have come up with?
I think we have three groups. Breakout group one, two, and then I think the medicine group was working locally.
Okay, so maybe start with group one.
So I didn't hear which group you said, but I'm going to start out now. In group one, we had questions about how you can be sure that your assessment is valid, that you're really measuring what you want to measure, and how generalizable the results from these very, well, situation-specific classroom from these classroom, well, not experiment, but from these classroom settings, how generalizable the results might be?
Yes, I think those are great questions. And I think in terms of assumptions of validity, I believe that they are not unique to design-based research because any study that and any measure that you use, you have to make sure that you know it's valid. So we can come back to this issue of whether, you know, whether it's unique to design-based research in a bit. But I think the more important question, not that the other one is not important, but the more pressing question is that of generalization. And that's really an issue that we struggle with a lot, generalization and replication, and a lot of the critics of design-based research have raised that issue. And I think as the field is moving forward, we are kind of thinking about this in many different ways. And it reminds me of an article which is also, you know, on my mentioned on one of my slides. If I can figure out which slide, it's 26. How do you characterize implementations? And it's about the social infrastructure model that Kate Bilacik talks about. And she has this, notion of looking, how do you, you know, slowly increase the complexity of design-based research? So you might start with what she calls an existence proof. And, you know, it kind of falls along like one of the dimensions that I mentioned in my chart. So you try and understand the stability and feasibility of your innovation in the context for which it was designed. So it might be the local context, and you're trying to understand how your particular innovation works in that context. But as you expand to multiple classrooms or multiple contexts, she starts thinking about how does it work in different contexts, and describes what she calls a double design matrix, where you're very carefully documenting the designed intention and the variations that different teachers make. And I believe that over time, when you have this matrix of, you know, what was the designed intention for particular aspects of your design, and then what variations did the teachers make, and how did that impact learning? Over time, I think you might be able to, or hopefully you will be able to, collect enough data and enough points that you might be able to come up with some generalizations. But because design-based research happens in a complex context, it's not like you're able to replicate, an experimental design in another setting and not worry about the complexity. So I think we are now thinking about and coming up with ways in which we can document some of the complexity and the ways in which, you know, over time we can make our designs more generalizable, but I don't think we are there yet.
Hi, I think you just addressed a lot of the topics that we had discussed about generalizability, and we are kind of thinking about the term that you were using earlier about humble theories. And kind of asking whether or not we can move from these more humble theories to something that is more generalizable and more broadly and widely accepted using design-based research.
So I think I might have answered that question, you know, that over time you might be able to generate theories which are more generalizable. Do people have any other questions?
Well, Sarana, I have two questions for at the end that we ask all the presenters. Not sure if we should go for these now. Okay, so one question is, and I think you partly answered it, and it was already in the chat before. I think one of the breakout groups discussed about how is design-based research fitting the needs of a PhD student, or to what extent can design-based research given these trajectories, be part of a PhD project, or in which ways can a PhD project be seen as part of this trajectory? So this is one question, maybe a bit complex. And the second question would be, how would you relate this topic to the learning sciences, which is obviously a quite an easy task in part, superficially, I mean, because some of us already mentioned that this might be the maybe one core method of the learning sciences. But maybe if you could give us your perspective, why is this method so important for the learning sciences? That would be my second question.
Okay, so I'll give this a shot, and I think doctoral dissertations can actually fit these trajectories. One of the studies that I mentioned in my slides about meta-navigation support was done by my doctoral student as part of our, iterative development and implementation of our software and curriculum. And she was able to take a couple of weeks in during our 12-week implementation and actually create randomized groups, assigning classrooms to different conditions, randomly assigning them, and was able to conduct her study. Another master's student also was able to do that. And then I have dissertations in the works and completed where, we've been able to take like small sections of our large implementations and look at like a particular focused question, depending on the interest of the student, of course, but also that feeds into the design of the innovation and that feeds into our understanding of how students learn. So I hope that I have answered that question. And then why is it important to the learning sciences? I think more and more learning, more than any other field in education research, I think the learning sciences, we actually design innovations that are complex, that consist of curricula, that consist of software, different kinds of tools, augmented reality, and we are very interested in how these things work in a real context and really interested in how people learn in natural settings. So I think all the more having a research method that is unique, just like design-based research, is something that is very important to the learning sciences.
Well, thank you very much, Sarah, for these answers. I was wondering if these webinar series would also lend itself for some design-based research. Thanks. I think maybe we can have a quick round of, saying bye-bye or having a quick comment at the end, and then you will have the final word. I would like to thank you very much. So I was not, I have to admit, before reading the text and listening to you, I was not so aware of this quite interesting and far-reaching reflections that already exist on the trajectories. And I think that is maybe the most important aspect of design-based research that should be addressed by the community right now. At least I'm convinced, I have been convinced by your speech today. So thanks a lot, and maybe we have the quick round, and then you have the final words, and bye-bye.
So thanks a lot from my side. It's been very interesting. I didn't know very much about design-based research and wasn't like even thinking about doing it, but now it seems much more doable with all the knowledge I gained today. Thanks a lot. The second thing I would want to mention is a short evaluation about the webinar. I'm just posting the link to the evaluation in the chat. It only takes 2 to 3 minutes, and I literally mean that. It would be really cool if all of you could take these 2 or 3 minutes and do the evaluation. Thank you very much and have a nice day. Bye-bye.
Selena, thank you very much from my side too and for this enlightening talk about design-based research. And I would also like to thank you for filling out the evaluation Daniel just posted. Thanks, Daniel, for that.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it a lot, and I enjoyed our breakout groups too. Our second breakout group had a good session, and I was thankful for the opportunity to chat with others as well. And thanks for putting this together, Frank and Sadhana.
Well, thank you all for attending, especially those of you in Europe. I know it's really late there on a Friday evening. So thanks, Frank, and thanks everybody else. It was great for me to kind of reflect on this topic and really think about, you know, how our work fits in it, because, you know, I think one thing that we really need to start doing in the learning sciences is focus on our trajectories and not do it post hoc, but think ahead of time about, you know, what this means and what our questions are and how do we plan our studies. And because design-based research is a fairly new method, I feel like sometimes we do a lot of stuff post hoc rather than thinking ahead of time. So thank you all.